G'day and welcome to episode 66 of this little podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is Perry Middlemas and I'm here as always with my good friend David Grigg. Now David,
yes,
is a man who I'm sure has experienced this strange emotion known as velature.
Velature. Well, you have to explain to me what it is, but it's quite possible.
It's the strange wistfulness of used bookstores.
Ah, yes.
What a strange term this is. This comes from the Dictionary of Obscure Sorrows.
Ah.
Now, there's an interesting title by a bloke called John Koenig. It's a great title. I love weird dictionaries of strange things. Most of these are made-up words, but some of them are starting to get a little bit of traction. And so I like the idea of the strange wistfulness of used bookstores. So I thought that I'd throw that one in there for you, David.
Very nice, very nice.
So how have you been?
Oh, pretty well, you know, pretty well.
Reading a lot?
Reading a lot. I'm still trying to catch up with some of the award winners that are around, but I'm getting there. I've put a lot of books on hold at the library, and I think I've said before, the trouble is that you wait and wait for these things, and suddenly all, you know, then three of them arrive at once, and that's happened here. I've got The Labyrinth by Amanda Lowry. I've got that in hand, waiting for me at the library, which I'll pick up tomorrow. The Rain Heron. And there's one other book which I can't remember what it is, but yeah, this heap of books that just arrive because I've had them on hold for ages, and they take ages, of course, because they're award winners and everybody wants to read them. So that's all right. Some of them are coming up.
So when you get them, you don't have a choice about sort of saying no, I'll put it off a little.
Well,
bit.
No, that's right. Because you can't defer it because everyone else wants to read it too. So yeah.
Well, you go to the back of the queue. And if the queue's like 25 long, that could be a good year before you get back to it again. So always best to grab a hold of it.
Indeed.
So that's good. Yes. Well, we're coming near the end of the year, and I think people should be starting to think about, probably already should have been thinking about what books they're going to get, especially if they want them delivered. I know that my local bookstore, Readings, has put out a note saying that if you want to have your books confirmed as being delivered before Christmas, that you need to put your orders in by December 1.
Mm-hmm.
That's very early because we're having a lot of trouble with postal services both here and overseas. And even though things are starting to open up, there's still a lot of problems with the pandemic-induced COVID lockdowns and people having to isolate and not enough people being able to do the work and not enough delivery drivers and all that sort of stuff. And that just all goes together to hold up postal deliveries, which is a real pity, but hey, what can you do? All you can do is just put the orders in. I mean, I put some of my orders in for the family early in November, and I've got a whole heap of them already sitting here. They've already turned up.
No, that's right.
So the next thing I've got to do is wrap them and then put them in the designated present spot so that on Christmas morning, over a glass of something sparkling white and Australian, we can open them all up.
Yeah, that sounds very pleasant.
Yeah, it's always a good thing to have a couple of books given to you, even though you've told people exactly what it is you want. Part of the difficulty is you want to read them as soon as possible. And other things are, well, you have to give people something to give you.
That's right. I've been in trouble with my daughter before for going out and buying the books that I said I wanted, and she's gone and bought them for me, so she's had to return them.
I try not to do that. No, you have to. This is what email's for. You have to basically send a little note around saying, what does everybody want for Christmas?
Yes, yes.
And then you get the list and they have to give you a list.
And they're not allowed to go and buy them themselves.
No, that's exactly right. The other problem, of course, you've got is that, like for you and I, David, when we get to our age, what do we want for Christmas?
Very little, that's right.
Very little. Yeah. I mean, it's basically, a couple of books would be good.
A bottle of wine or two.
Bottle of wine, maybe a bottle of gin or something like that, but I don't want any clothing, and I don't want any ties anymore, and I've got more socks than I know what to do with, so I don't really know, other than books. So books are what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, there we go. News, David.
News.
We actually have news, believe it or not. The Titmar Awards were announced within this past week. Now, for those that don't know, the Dittmar Awards are really the Australian Science Fiction and Fantasy Achievement Awards. These are normally voted on and presented at each Australian National Convention each year, but this year's had to be cancelled. And so they decided to do it as an online event, which happened last week. And so they had to work around a whole lot of things. And some people were saying, well, it's not constitutional because you're not doing it at the National Convention. But come on, let's just... Let's move beyond that, shall we? So I'll just give you the highlights for the major awards.
Sure.
Best novel went to The Left-Handed Booksellers of London by Garth Nix.
Mm-hmm.
Best novella or novelette went to Fly Away by Kathleen Jennings. I wasn't overly impressed with that one, but, you know, I actually got taken to task a little bit by somebody. Somebody said that I was a bit rough on the on Flyaway. Possibly I was, but as we discussed last week, David, I'm not a critic, I'm a reviewer, and I can only go from my personal perspective on a piece of fiction that I read. And when I do that, I attempt to tell people why I liked it or didn't like it. But I find it difficult to step away from my like or dislike and get through to it. If I can't get into the story, I have to basically say that I can't get into it, and I couldn't get into that one. So that's just the way it goes. Well, I'm happy to see that it won. Mm. It just wasn't the one for me. Best short story was The Calentura by Karen Warren. Best collected work, Dark Harvest by Kat Sparks. Best fan writer, Bruce Gillespie. Our friend of the podcast, Bruce Gillespie. Best fan publication in any medium. It wasn't us, David.
No, dear.
It was the Coot Street Podcast by Jonathan Strawn and Gary K. Wolfe, which has been around forever and a day.
Yes.
I think they're well into their 500s episodes, although they did a lot of 10-minute episodes at one point during the lockdown, which were pretty good. William Atheling Jr. Award for Criticism or Review. Terry Frost for Reviews in Terry Talks Movies, mm-hmm. which is his YouTube channel.
Oh, there you go.
So that's good. So that was out, and that worked all right. Now, the other one, Amazon Best Books of 2021.
Yes.
Amazon's okay with doing this in... around about this time, in my view, because they've seen all of the 2021 books.
Yeah, they know what's coming out.
You and I won't have, because some of them haven't been released. They're still going to be released in the next week or so, because you're not going to get much late in December. Publishers want to get their books out so that people can purchase them for Christmas, which means October, November in general. Now, while we haven't finished our reading for 2021, of books from any year that we cover, Amazon picks the best books that were published during this particular year, 2021. I'll just give you the top five for science fiction and fantasy. Project Hail Mary by Andy Weir. A Court of Silver Flames by Sarah J. Maas, M-A-A-S. The Crown of Gilded Bones by Jennifer L. Armentrout. Clara and the Sun by Kazuo Ishiguro. I've actually got a copy of that, so that's interesting. I'll read that. And The Last Graduate by Naomi Novik.
Okay.
In the Mysteries and Thrillers, the top five were The Dark Hours by Michael Connolly.
Oh, yeah.
We know Michael Connolly. The Plot by Keen Hanf Korolitz. Lightning Strike by William Kent Kruger. That's interesting because I was a really big fan of Ordinary Grace by William Kent Kruger a month or so back,
mm-hmm.
which is good. Chasing the Boogeyman by Richard Chismar and Razorblade Tears by S.A. Cosby.
Mm-hmm.
Razorblade Tears is a good title, and S.A. Cosby wrote Blacktop Wasteland, which is also a very good title, which is another one that I liked quite a lot earlier in the year. So
interesting.
Some of those names are recurring.
Indeed.
Which is good.
Hmm.
Which is good. The only other piece of news that I have is a bit personal, in that I am the interviewer for a Zoom session coming up in a couple of weeks, or December the 4th, Sunday, December the 4th, to be exact. Now, this is a Zoom session for FANAC, that's F-A-N-A-C, which is a science fiction term, of course, for Fanish activity. But FANAC are a group of people based in the US, for which I do a bit of work. The major powers behind this are Joe Sicilia and Edie Stern, and their aim is to act as a sort of archive, central repository for scanned fanzines, of which they have a vast number. These are all readily and easily available and accessible by anybody just by going to fanac.org and following through the links and just searching around to see what you can find. But they're also undertaking a series of Zoom sessions for Fanish Histories. And they contacted me to see whether I would be able to persuade friend of the podcast, Lee Edmonds, to talk about his ongoing Australian science fiction Fanish history, which he is working on at the moment, and which he's discussed on this podcast 18 months, 2 years ago?
Sounds about right.
Long time ago. Early days,
yeah, it was,
for the podcast. So basically the topic for this particular Zoom session, the title is Wrong Turns on the Wallaby Track, Australian Science Fiction Fandom to Ozicon, Part 1, 1936 to 1960. So we're only taking it up to 1960 at this point. And then later on, sometime in a year's time, maybe 18 months' time, when Lee's finished his piece that runs from 1960 through to Ozicon in 1975, then we'll come back and do the second part of this particular topic. Now, I don't have a Zoom link for this particular session at the moment, because it hasn't been decided and exactly what it's going to be. The best thing to do is, if you're interested in listening in on this, to go to the fanac.org website and you'll see the link, and you can keep an eye on when the Zoom link is going to be announced, which is good. They're also going to be recording it, so they'll have it available for viewing later, and will probably go up on their YouTube channel. So I'll be a multimedia megastar after this. Yeah. My aim is to ask a question, then just step back and just let Lee go, because Lee knows it all, and I have infinite faith that he will be able to carry the whole thing. And if I mess up, he'll just keep on going, which is exactly what I'm probably going to need, I think, David.
Fair enough.
Yep, that's about it. Anything else?
Yeah. Well, if you're going to do your personal Zoom thing.
Yep.
I might mention that I recently did a presentation for the Open Publishing Fest, which is all about publishing and in a sort of open source sort of way. And I did a presentation on standard ebooks, and I'll put a link in the show notes to the YouTube clip of my presentation, which runs for about 20 minutes. So,
okay, yep. Good.
So that's yep.
I haven't seen that yet. I shall, when you put the link up, I shall go and have a bit of a look.
Indeed.
And see what you have to say.
Pretty well, yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good. It's good to know. Now, we've got a couple of letters of comment.
We have letters of comment. Wow.
Do you want to have a talk about them?
Well, I'll mention the one from, we had one from Ben Sims. So Ben writes, greetings from Norfolk, England. I discovered the podcast by following the breadcrumbs from Perry's output on eFanzines. That's eFanzines.org, I take it. Mm-hmm. Thanks for opening my eyes to some great Australian authors. The Hugo Time Machine is really interesting, and I appreciate the research that goes into it. And then he asks for some information about some literary SF conventions in the UK, which I think Perry responded to. He also says, what are your thoughts on audiobooks? I've avoided them for books I haven't read yet, a bit like not seeing the film if you haven't read the book. But for classics I'm familiar with and want to reread, they're perfect. Well, I'm very fond of audiobooks, or at least I was very fond of audiobooks, and I don't see any reason to defer listening to an audiobook because you haven't read the book yet. I read a lot of books, read in quotes, I listened to a lot of books for the first time in audiobook format. A long time ago, when my daughter was still going to school, which is a long time ago, I used to have a very, very long commute, a terrible commute. It was like an hour and a half from home to work. And a lot of that was, you know, sort of three quarters of an hour to an hour of that was bumper to bumper traffic on the Eastern Freeway. And I was literally going insane. But I discovered audiobooks. And so once I started to listen to audiobooks in the car, that was terrific because I, you know, it sort of kept me interested. I was following the story and sort of got to, used to drive along and get to work and be a bit sad that I got to work because I wanted to keep listening to the story. So so literally audiobooks saved my sanity at one point in my life. So I'm very fond of audiobooks. But now, because I'm retired and work from home, I don't have a commute. So I've listened to them very, very rarely, which is a bit of a pity. What do you like audiobooks, Perry?
I really haven't delved into that area of books at all, David. I couldn't really tell you one way or the other. I know that, as you'll be aware, that I'm originally from South Australia, and the drive from Melbourne to Adelaide is a good 8-9 hours, and with children can be anything up to 10.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that a few times. And I know that we put an audio book on in the car. I'm sure that we listened to The Hobbit at one stage, which the kids really liked. And there was a couple of others that we listened to on long distance travel. And that works really well. These days when I'm floating around, my wife and I have a tendency to listen to other podcasts. Occasionally listen to this and I cringe and turn it off very rapidly because you always sound very, very weird when you listen to your own voice after it's been recorded.
Mm-hmm.
But we listen to podcasts. You know, some of them will be 30 minutes, some of them will be an hour, and we bounce them around between one and another and keep track of where we're up to. And that's basically what we listen to. I haven't really thought about audiobooks, but I can't see there's anything wrong in it other than the fact that it just takes a bit longer because somebody's saying the words out loud just takes longer than you having to read the words on your own. So anyway,
I think the other thing you've got to be concerned about is the narrator. Occasionally you sort of look at an audiobook and you find the narrator has just got a voice that just grates on you, and that's hopeless. But it's often good if the author themselves has read the book, if they've got a good voice. Neil Gaiman is actually very good at reading his own books. One of his books, which I think is terrific as an audiobook, is Anansi Boys, which is narrated by Lenny Henry. And in fact, he wrote Anansi Boys with Lenny Henry in mind as a character, and so it works brilliantly. And so that's one of the best audiobooks if you want to get into it. It's a follow-up to American Gods. It's Anansi Boys. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
Well, I was just watching a program the other night, and Marion Margulies was on with Stephen Fry on an episode of the Graham Norton Show, and she actually mentions the fact that Stephen Fry read or did the audio book reading for all of J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter novels.
Yeah, I've listened to a few of those,
And she said he was just fantastic.
Yeah, he's good, yeah.
Absolutely the best that she had ever heard, and he was quite chuffed to get that feedback after all this time. But as you say, if you get the right one and it works well, that's what you need.
Yeah, indeed. All right. Well, we could talk about that for hours, but we won't.
No, we won't. We'll also just mention we got a letter of comment from our old friend Don Ashby, who's doing okay out there in Mallacoota after losing his house a couple of years ago in the massive bushfires. So he's back listening to the podcast, he said, and he's enjoying it, which is good. And he said he likes to listen to us talk about old classic SF, which seems to be the thing that a lot of people like, because a lot of them have read it and they just like to listen to us rabbit on with our opinions about what's good and what isn't. But anyway,
indeed,
moving on to the main topic, one of the main topics of this particular podcast, because we've got another one coming up a bit later, we're going to talk about a few books that we've been reading lately. So, David, do you want to...
Do you want me to start?
Lead us off.
All right. Okay, this is a book called She Who Became the Sun by Shelley Parker Chan. And this is the debut novel for this Australian author. And it's very good. It's historical fiction set in China toward the close of the Yuan dynasty in the mid-1300s, at a time when China was ruled by its Mongol conquerors. So the book begins in a poor village in the middle of a devastating drought, and many people starving to death. The crops have failed because of the drought. And we see this situation through the eyes of a young girl who is perhaps 10 or 11 years old at when the book opens. And she's one of the few girls who have remained alive in the village because, of course, if a family doesn't have enough food to go around, they give it to their sons and not their daughters. But this girl, whose name we never learn, has, however, managed to survive by trapping insects and small animals like lizards and eating them secretly. The girl's mother died some time previously, but her father has, until recently, been able to scrape a living from the land. Anyway, the time goes by and he takes the girl and her brother to see the local fortune teller. The fortune teller examines the boy, whose name is Zhu Chongba. That's Z-H-U-C-H-O-N-G-B-A, Zhu Chongba. I presume it's something pronounced something like that. And the fortune teller is astonished. He sort of raises his hands. "This child," he says, "this child has greatness in him. His deeds will bring 100 generations of pride to your family name." So her father's obviously overjoyed. And after her father and her brother have left, the girl sneaks back into the hut of the fortune teller and timidly asks the old man about her own fate. "Nothing," says the old man coldly. "Nothing." So she's just downcast. But then, a little later on, her father is killed by bandits who are looking for food in the middle of this drought and famine. And her brother, because their father's died, her brother grows listless, refuses to eat, and he dies. So much for this great fortune. But the girl, who survived, is determined to seek her brother's lost greatness for herself. Taking on his name and identity and pretending to be a boy, she sets off to walk to a monastery to which her brother had been promised entry as a novitiate. And from there, we follow the fate of, in quotes, because it's not her real name, we follow the fate of Zhu Chongba as she is trained as a monk, still managing to conceal her gender in the middle of this all-male monastery. Tricky, but she's very clever. And then later on, after she's graduated as a monk, she joins the rebel army, who are trying to overthrow the current rulers. And her really sharp intelligence and courage leads her from one very unlikely step to another, step by step, to seek out the greatness that's been promised to someone of her name, or her brother's name. As part of this, she finds herself in continuing bitter conflict with one general, a eunuch called Uyang, who is secretly pursuing an agenda of his own. And so the inner thoughts of both of these characters, badly misunderstood by the people that they're closest to. So the story is mostly straight historical fiction, but it does have elements of fantasy, apart from whether you think that this is likely or not that she could achieve these things. So Zhu Chongba can see ghosts, for example, and the rebel army manages to locate someone called the Prince of Radiance, who was a child imbued with a visible spiritual glow, which is the mandate of heaven. And this child remembers all of his previous incarnations. And the child becomes a source of inspiration to the rebel troops and a confirmation that their cause is a just cause. So I won't go into any more detail about how she gets from step to step from being a monk to being essentially a general leading the rebel troops. But I liked it a lot. I mean, some of her actions, particularly towards the end, are pretty disturbing. I mean, she's absolutely ruthless in pursuit of her stolen fate. And it can be a bit unsettling. But nevertheless, I liked it a lot. Now, this is just the first book in a projected trilogy, which I'll certainly be following up on the other books in the trilogy. Yeah, so I give this a lot of points. It's good.
Okay, sounds interesting. I'm also going to be talking today about Australian books, the first of which is the third of Clive James's autobiographical series, which are all published under the general series title of Unreliable Memoirs, which was also the name of the first one. The second one of these was Falling Towards England. And the one that I'm just talking about today is May Week Was in June. Now, if people are remembering, I was really impressed and really liked the first one in this series, Unreliable Memoirs. Not quite as enamoured with the second. And it's moving downhill again with this third one, unfortunately. I mean, this one's sort of satisfactory and competent. You know? I gave it 3.2, and if you just read this one fresh, you would probably think, yeah, this is pretty good. But I have to stack this up against the first and the second one in this particular series. And it seems a little bit lacking. Anyway, to get to the particular book. So at the end of the previous volume in this series, Clive James has spent 2 years mooching around London, not really doing very much, just trying to eke out a living, but has finally been accepted to an undergraduate degree at Cambridge University, and this volume follows his time there. Now, he quickly, once he gets there, decides that, you know, dramatics is all the thing that he needs, and he wanders along to the Footlights tent on the very first, sort of in like we used to call orientation week or whatever week they call it over here in Melbourne. But anyway, so he goes along, and the first person he finds is Eric Idle, who's sitting behind the table. And so he basically latches onto Eric and latches onto the Footlights, and his future life starts to be sketched in, basically. Now, he's ostensibly reading English, and he's supposed to be doing that, but he reads everything else. And there's a whole lot of prescribed texts that he's supposed to be reading. He's supposed to be writing essays every fortnight and handing them in for review. He reads everything bar what he's supposed to be reading. He doesn't read that. He doesn't write any essays. He starts to learn Italian because he wants to read something in Italian. And then he starts to learn French. He skips classes. He drinks too much, smokes too much, throws himself head first into the University Dramatic Society and just totally makes a mess of his whole time there. He barely scrapes through his exams at the end of the first. Well, he doesn't have at the end of the first year because he's not handing in his essays when he's supposed to. The master of his college says, I think it'd be a good idea if you found digs elsewhere. There is actually a room available in this particular rooming house. So he toddles along to the rooming house and it's absolutely and utterly woeful. But in the room next door is Germaine Greer, who is not called Germaine Greer in the book. I've forgotten what her name is, but she's disguised, but it's bleedingly obvious who this is. And there's a long joke about the relationship between James and Greer. It comes out that at some time at university, Greer bet some of her friends that she was going to be able to get this gormless James into bed within 24 hours. And she lost the bet because he ran away from her. But now he's got himself a little bit more confidence. So he starts going after her. She just won't have a bar of him. I mean, she was just part of a bet, and that was all that it was. All she was interested in. And he's a bit more keen on her. But he finds the whole experience of her being in the room next door very difficult because she's just started to do the major feminist writing work that would lead towards the female eunuch. And she's hammering away on this typewriter all day. And he just can't stand the noise of this typewriter of the person next door, hardly taking a break for anything, just going at it flat out all day. And so he just basically leaves and just goes off and does all of his stuff. At the end of 2 years, he barely scrapes through his exams, but he does get through. And somehow or other, he's offered a PhD at Cambridge University. God knows how this happened. I mean, really, it's just almost impossible to figure out how he actually does this. But he does, and he gets there. I mean, he's a man that falls on his feet almost continuously wherever he goes. And then he proceeds to stuff up his PhD by doing exactly the same during the time of his PhD as he was doing in his undergraduate degree. And doesn't make it through. And in the end decides that he really doesn't want to do this PhD. He was more interested in hanging around Cambridge to work with the Footlights, you know, starting to perform, writing and performing, and then directing and taking the Footlights up to the Edinburgh Fringe, and then into London to perform on West End. And along the way, he starts earning a bit of money by writing book reviews and travel pieces for various magazines in London. And he starts to realise that, honestly, his best bet is to get into what is referred to as literary London. And that's where he heads towards at the end of this particular book. The difficulty is that, apart from those running jokes with Germaine Greer and a couple of bits and pieces here and there, all of his humour, which really was fresh and bright in Unreliable Memoirs, now it just seems a little forced and stale. It's not, just doesn't seem to have the verve that it once had. And so you actually find that he used to be short, sharp and snappy in his early stuff, and now he's becoming overly verbose with his writing. And I actually got to the thought near the end of this particular book that he'd written it because he was contracted to rather than because he really wanted to. And he says at the end of this, right, that's enough, I'm sort of pretty much I'm done now with my memoirs. But he wasn't. There were still another couple of volumes to come later on. But this one's not to the standard of the previous two, which is rather disappointing. As I said, it's satisfactory, and it's a competent autobiography, but just doesn't have the spark that I really wanted to get from a Clive James autobiography, unfortunately.
Oh, there we are. Never mind. All right, well, I'm going to roll on to what I think is the best book I've read so far this year.
Ooh, okay, it's a big statement.
Yeah. And this is Bewilderment by Richard Powers. It's hard to know where to start to talk about it, really, except to say that I'm pretty sure it's the best book I've read this year. I probably need to think about it for another couple of weeks to be absolutely certain about that and think about some of the other books I've read, but I'm pretty sure it's certainly going to be in the top 10 and probably the top 5 of the books I've read this year, maybe at number 1. We'll see. So suffice it to say that I think it's very good. It's beautifully written, and it's so very, very relevant to the real world, real people, and our current situation in the world. So it's written in the first person by a man called Theo Byrne, who's an astronomer. Specifically, he's an astrobiologist. And he's, in his professional work, he's coming up with ways to detect and analyse the atmospheres of exoplanets in a search for signs of life, and of course, possibly intelligent life. But more importantly, the book is about Theo's son, Robin. He's introduced with these words, which I think is just lovely, lovely prose. So, quote here, "Robin, my sad, singular, newly turning 9-year-old, in trouble with this world." Robin is indeed in trouble with this world. He might be autistic or have Asperger's syndrome or something along those lines. Robin is intense, passionate, compulsive, easily frightened, easily angered, sometimes violent as a 9-year-old. But Theo has had any number of competing diagnoses for his son's condition, none of which he agrees with. And I'm going to quote again. "When a condition gets 3 different names over as many decades, when it requires 2 subcategories to account for completely contradictory symptoms, when it goes from non-existent to the country's most commonly diagnosed childhood disorder in the course of one generation, when 2 different physicians want to prescribe 3 different medications, there's something wrong." So Theo strongly resists having Robin put on any medication, and as the book opens, he's taken his son out of school and onto a trip into the mountains, trying to calm him, settle him down by engaging his love of the wilderness and of living creatures, something that Robin has inherited from his mother, Elissa, who died a few years earlier in a car accident. So Theo and Robin often talk about Theo's search for life outside the Earth, and specifically about finding intelligent life out there. And as one way to calm Robin's wildly spinning mind, Theo tells him bedtime stories of other worlds which his work might enable us to detect. These stories are fascinating imaginary worlds, but based firmly on scientific possibility. I really don't want to say a great deal more about how the story unfolds, except to say that early on, Theo reads the novel Flowers for Algernon to his son. And now Perry talked about Flowers for Algernon in the last episode. Now, so he reads the book to his son, who becomes very upset about the fate of the mouse in the story. And in some ways, bewilderment is a homage to that book, Flowers for Algernon. And there are some similarities, but it's not by no means a copy of the plot of that book. But it's about so many things. It's about the current state of American politics. In the novel, there's a Trump-like president who sends out messages in all caps and who denigrates science. It's about the climate catastrophe we're in the middle of and our apparent inability to do anything much about it, about our turning away from science and logic. But much more importantly, it's about fathers and sons, about love and about heartbreak. Not many books bring me to tears, but this one did. Highly, highly recommended. Now, it was on the shortlist both for this year's Booker Prize and the US National Book Award. It didn't actually win either of those, but by crikey, it was a good contender. Now, I believe that Richard Powers' earlier book, The Overstory, won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction, and it was also on the Booker Prize shortlist when it came out. And I must try and get hold of that, because that's very highly regarded too. So, yeah, this was a wonderful book, great book, but very, very moving. And very, very sad.
It's getting a lot of buzz. These last two have. Overstory got a lot of high critical acclaim when it was out last year. As you said, it won the Pulitzer and was on the shortlist for the Booker. This year he's on the shortlist again, or long list.
He was on the shortlist, actually, yeah.
On the shortlist again. There you go. So, yes, it's obviously he's hitting a high point in his writing career, and I better get my skates on and have a bit of a read and find out what's happening. Because if you're saying it's good and a whole lot of other people are saying it's pretty good, then I think it's probably one of these things I should follow up.
Yeah, it's excellent. That's all I can say.
Well, I'm also going to end my discussion of books today with a discussion of an excellent book. This is called Fathoms, The World in the Whale, which was published in 2020 by Australian journalist Rebecca Giggs. It's a non-fiction book. It was actually shortlisted for the 2021 Stella Prize because that covers fiction and non-fiction.
Yeah.
It didn't win, but if it had, I would not have been at all surprised after having read this. Now, this book was published by Scribe originally in 2020. I completely missed it when it was out. I wasn't obviously paying attention terribly much. And then I happened to be reading an issue of the New York Review of Books, to which I have a subscription. And I came across a review of this particular book, which is titled Requiem for a Heavyweight, which is a fair enough title because this book is about whales. But the one thing that caught my particular eye was one sentence in this review that talks about this particular book and says, Fathoms, The World in the Whale is perhaps the finest book written about whales since Moby Dick was published 170 years ago. It's also one of the best accounts I've ever read of the interaction, intended and unintended, between humans and other species, a work of genuinely literary imagination. Now, for a non-fiction piece of work, that's pretty high praise.
It is, yes.
And that sort of caught my eye, and I thought, yeah, I really should go out and read this. And by God, I'm glad that I did. This is an excellent piece of work. I don't know whether you remember me talking about a book called Underworld by Robert McFarlane a couple of years ago, which was also one of my top five best books of that year, I think. And I was really impressed with that as a form of, as it just shows you what non-fiction can do. with a particular topic, and I think this one is sort of up into that sort of bounds, which sounds strange, but it basically is. So what's the book about? It's about whales. Now, it covers everything. It starts off with the author recounting an encounter that she has with a whale on a beach in Western Australia, where she is originally from. And this whale's washed up on the beach, and people turn up and try and help it out. And it's completely stranded, and it can't get out, but it's not dead. And so people are trying to put water on it to try and keep it alive and try to do things. And they try and get a hold of the Department of Fisheries, who in classic bureaucratic fashion say, whales are nothing to do with us. Whales are mammals. We deal with fish.
Oh, goodness me.
And therefore, nothing to do with us. Oh, go dear. Away. So then, classic crap, really. And because it was too difficult to work out what to do. So anyway, the one wildlife guy turns up, who's from the Department of Wildlife, probably. She starts talking to him. He says, well, can't we put it down? He said, well, you got a problem. You can't shoot them. Because, you know, you could basically just cause minor damage and just make it more uncomfortable for them. There's only two ways of killing them, really. And that is, one of them is to basically put them to sleep. But how much barbiturates do you give a whale of this size? And what impact's that going to have on the flesh that's left behind? And if, you know, and you can't tow it out to sea, because you can't get it out far enough, because you get it out to sea and let it drift, and then the sharks come in, and the sharks eat it, and then the sharks start attacking the people because they're, you know, they're in that sort of particular area. One of the ways to do it, says the guy, is to blow it up with explosives. But how much explosives do you use? So she has this conversation, and this is a really distressing conversation she's having with this bloke, but he's having to have this, and he's thought it through. And he says, there's nothing I can do. I can't work out what to do. We just don't know what to do. And they basically sit there and watch it die. And she then starts becoming interested in how whales have impacted us as a species. And they have massively, when you go into it, so many items of new technology or lubricants. Well, whale oil lubricants were still being used in the space program in the early 1970s.
Good heavens.
I didn't know that. No. But they had such a wonderful lubricant quality that it was the best material around. Then, of course, whaling was banned by the International Whaling Commission. Countries like Iceland and Norway were allowed to do it for particular cultural reasons, although I'm very dubious about Iceland's note with this. I love Iceland, but when I was there a couple of years ago, it was brought up. The conversation was brought up with our guide about whale meat, and he was adamant that the only reason why Iceland took whale meat was for the tourists, because the tourists kept on saying they wanted to eat it. My response was, well, just tell them it's not bloody available. Oh, can't do that. Yes, you can. You just say it's not available. And that's it. Didn't seem to think this was workable. So we changed the subject because there wasn't much point. And the other one, of course, is Japan. But one that I wasn't aware of was the amount of whales that Russia had taken. Anyway, in this particular book, she actually goes into the details about some of the mass culling that had gone on. Some particular whales had gone from an estimated over 200,000 individual species down to 250 by the time that the whaling had stopped, and now they're making a comeback. She deals with the impact a whale carcass has on the ocean floor, and what it does to the sea life. It's quite astounding when you think about everything that goes on with whales and what such a massive resource it is in terms of a vast decaying piece of flesh. That she was saying that something in the vicinity of each whale, the amount of carbon that's hurled in each whale's carcass is the equivalent of around about 2,000 to 3,000 trees. And when you get to that level, you start thinking that there's a massive change that's happened in the world because of all the whaling. Now, this isn't an emotional, or not overly emotional, account of Rebecca Giggs's experience of whales and what she's learnt about them. Although it becomes emotional purely on the basis that what she talks about is just disturbing. You know, that she talks about it in a very journalistic style, and she's not there beating a drum to say you've got to get up and do this yet, but she just puts the facts down in front of him. And the length of them, the breadth of them, the depth of them gets to the point where it sort of builds in you and you really know what is happening. And that becomes the emotional part for you as an individual. This is an excellent book about whales, and I really think that it's one that if you want to read anything about it, whales, I think this is one that you need to go to. I'm very interested in the subtitle for this. It's the main title of this is Fathoms. The subtitle is The World in the Whale. It's not the whale in the world, giving you an indication of where the whale fits in. It's the world in the whale, namely that the whale is a world unto itself and how it interacts with the other world around it. And I thought that's a really excellent subtitle choice. Just that little change of word, if you think about it, you get, oh, okay. This is a great book. This is a really, really good book. And I gave this about 4.5 out of 5. And the more I think about it, the more I think I should bump it a little bit higher than that. This is a book that is one of those ones that will stay with me for a long period of time. I got it from the library, and I'm seriously thinking I'm going to have to go out and buy a copy of it. I've got notes all the way, tags all the way right through it. So I'm showing David all the tags all the way right through this book, because all the time I kept on coming across, but I didn't know that. I didn't. Oh God, that's interesting. This is just a wonderful thing. Whales appear in the imagination of humans in a big way. I know that sounds ridiculous because they are big, but you know what I mean. They're there all the time. And if people basically think about whales, they normally think about big humpback whales. And I've seen one up close, and they are very, very impressive, as is this book. So I would recommend this heartily to people to go out and read it.
Excellent. Very good. Yes, that's the problem, isn't it? Borrowing books from the library is particularly if you don't take all your notes before they go back, and then you have to talk about them later. So I've been scrambling to remember names and things out of She Who Became the Sun, which went back to the library several weeks ago, and I'm thinking, what was the name of that? Anyway, never mind.
That's what I've got the most. Well, sometimes you have to basically, after that, look up reviews to sort of try and track down where the information comes from. But I'm seriously thinking I'm going to have to go
and buy a copy. Yeah, that's fair enough.
And just be done with it and try and remember where all my tags are, because I've got to take it back sometime this week and see what happens. Yeah. Anyway.
All right, very good. Okay, I believe we have something else.
Yeah, that's it for books for this week. And now that we are out of lockdowns, pretty much, in the state of Victoria, it gives me an opportunity at least to be able to go out and see a few people and actually visit them in their homes and record an interview with them. And that's what I've done just recently. Justin Aykroyd, who a lot of people that are listening to this podcast will know, is a long-time science fiction fan. I met him first back in about 1977. He's been a bookseller with Space Age Books and then on his own in Slow Glass Books. Yes, Slow Glass Books, named after the Bob Shaw story that we talked about only about a week ago. So all these connections that come through, David. And he's also a GUF winner, which is the Going Up or Getting Up fan fund winner, which takes an SF fan from Australia or New Zealand over to the UK and Europe, and he was the GUF winner way back, which he talks about. So he's somebody that a lot of people know. He's done a lot of auctioneering and a lot of conventions, a lot of dealing at. By dealing, I mean selling books at conventions, and so I thought he was a good one to include in our series of interviews with science fiction fans. So I started by asking Justin, as I normally do, how he got into this SF stuff in the first place. So, Justin, how did you get started?
How did I get started?
Started with all this science fiction stuff.
I had a love of books when I was growing up, and I was reading C.S. Lewis and Henry Treece and Rosemary Sutcliffe, and I didn't realise that C.S. Lewis was fantasy. I had no idea what science fiction was. About 1970, 71, I started looking at the shelves in a different manner, and I picked up Asimov and I picked up Bradbury and I started reading those. And then in 1971, I discovered a certain little shop in Melbourne.
Which one was that?
It was Merv Binn's Space Age Books.
Oh, okay.
And I turned up at Space Age Books and started buying stuff and reading more widely. And then I discovered Analog. And the first two issues I picked up happened to be the first two Ben Bover issues. And things like The Gold at Starbo's End by Fred Pohl, which went on to win awards, that sort of stuff. Yeah. Then I discovered fandom in a different manner by reading about the World Science Fiction Convention, which was coming in Melbourne in 1975, which was your first convention as well, Perry.
It was indeed. Now, you would have been at university by this stage? When did you start uni?
I started university in 1976.
Oh, okay. So you're still at high school?
I was still at high school down in Geelong.
All right, okay.
76, I was at Melbourne Uni studying science. And
so that was post-AussieCon. So leading up to AussieCon, you were coming up from Geelong on weekends and checking out the bookstore, were you?
There was that technique. I was coming up to Melbourne with sporting teams.
Oh, okay.
Playing hockey against other schools. And because I was a day boy, just drop me off here. And I'd go up to Space Age and take the train back to Geelong afterwards instead of taking the bus.
Oh, okay. Well, that worked out all right.
It worked out very well.
Okay. So you got to know science fiction in a bigger way through Space Age Books. So
That's right.
It was a fairly important bookstore for a lot of people.
It was incredibly important because it was the centre of fandom in a lot of ways.
But
there was also the Melbourne Uni Science Fiction Association, which is what I joined in 76.
Right, okay. Yep.
And I gather the Monash Group was very strong at that time as well.
Right. So you attended AussieCon?
I attended AussieCon, met no one.
Okay. Did you remember anybody afterwards?
Did I remember anyone afterwards? Having met some of the authors and had a brief chat, but I was an incredibly shy schoolboy at that stage. 1976 changed that a little bit. Unicon 2 at Ormond College.
Oh, yes, I was at that one.
Yes, I remember you there. I remember a lot of things happening. The introduction of Dungeons and Dragons by people like Gregor Wiley from Sydney. He came down with it and some of us started playing it. A little too obsessively, possibly, but that's the way that game was.
Well, when you think about it, back in that part of the 1970s, there really wasn't a lot of science fiction around. I mean, we hadn't quite hit the big impact of Star Wars just yet. We had very little on television at that time. And so if you had an interest in science fiction, you basically had to find your own way in a lot of ways. There wasn't much film. There wasn't much television.
No.
So it was books, comics, games, magazines. That was the sort of thing that was going on.
No. When my course wasn't going too well, I had been chatting with Merv Binns at Space Age, and I said, got any work going? And he said, no. And then one of the other guys said he was leaving, so I tried again. He said, give me your name and phone number. And the next week I got called because he'd flooded the shop upstairs. And I helped clean that up, and I finished up working 3 days, and then I finished up working the full week the next week, and that was the week I got to see Star Wars as a preview.
Okay. Well, that's good.
Yeah, that was quite useful.
Yeah, well, I actually got to see Star Wars as a preview because I won a ticket. Two tickets to go and see it through a competition in The Australian.
Yeah.
Just lucky. It's one of those things.
Yeah.
I mean, the questions they ask in the quiz were pretty easy, really, and I think anybody could have got them. I think the hardest one was, what was John Wyndham's full name? So I looked it up. I couldn't remember.
John Bainan, Harris, etc.
There's four or five middle names, which are...
That's the other writer I forgot. Reading Wyndham.
Which is the tough part. But anyway, so started work at Space Age.
I worked at Space Age until 1984.
Okay. All right. So 7 or 8 years. Okay. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
And so you just stayed on and stayed on and stayed on?
Stayed on and stayed on and stayed on. And then eventually I stood for the Get Up and Over fan fund. A little bit of a kick up the butt from John Foyster thinking that I should do it. And I finished up winning it. And those poor Brits didn't know what they were getting.
Right.
Because I was pretty much an unknown factor.
So you went to the... Which convention did you go to for 1984?
I went to CCon 79, which was run by John Brunner and others, including, I think, Alan Dorey, also known as Anal Dorey for his many spelling mistakes and typos.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And there I met many of the British fans that I'm still friends with, like even John Harvey and Joseph Nicholas, Judith Hanna, who sadly passed away, and I'm still in touch with many of them. Not as much as I would like to be, but I get over there and I get to see as many as I can.
So that was 1979.
79?
Yeah.
Sorry, 84 was Guff.
Oh, what are you talking about now? Yeah. How did you get to 1979? What was
I
that?
Don't know.
Did you actually go to the CCon in 1979?
Yeah, both were called CCon. I went to the CCon in 79 and I finished up being a Roman centurion in the masquerade to publicise the Australia in 83 bid.
Oh, that's right. That was the Sydney-based bid.
That was the Sydney-based bid, and nearly everyone who was on stage to publicise it was from Melbourne.
Interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, very interesting.
So, correcting ourselves here, you went to CCon.
Yeah.
And you were still working at Space Age at this time, and you stayed at Space Age through until...
1984.
And then is that when you left to go on your Guff trip?
That's when I left for my eight-month Guff trip.
Eight-month Guff trip. So that went... You went on Guff to the UK, and what was the convention you attended there?
That was the World Science Fiction Convention. No, it was the Easter Convention, which was CCon. That was the one run by Brunner, I think. Yes.
I can understand if you have two named CCon, it's pretty easy to get confused.
We are getting on, indeed. Yeah, it's all your fault.
So you go to the UK in 1984 and you hang around there for a while. Did you get into Europe as well?
No, I got into Europe. I went to a two-day convention in Stockholm. I went to a one-day convention in The Hague. And then I travelled around to Germany and caught up with a few of the German fans and basically did a bit of sightseeing. Followed up with conventions in Scotland at Albacon, where Jim Barker drew me as a teddy bear.
Which makes sense.
There was Silicon. I was also at the first Mexicon.
Oh, okay.
Which was absolutely spectacular. Probably rates as the best convention I've ever been to.
All right, okay. I went to one of those.
Yeah.
Yeah, where I think Howard Waldrop and Ian Banks were there.
We had Alistair Gray, who would...
really?
He really got stuck into the drinks, let's say, at the bar.
Okay.
I photographed him of him at early in the evening where he's looking absolutely fine, and the one later in the evening where he's looking a little dishevelled.
Worse for wear?
Yes, there's a few stains down his shirt and things like that. I think he absolutely had a ball.
Oh, good, good. Because he's not one of those authors that you normally would expect to see at a science fiction convention. But I suppose when they turn up and they find out that the SF fans are fairly large drinkers, most of them sort of think, well, this is my place. This is where I need to be. And so I know that Banks used to enjoy going along to them, because you'd always find somebody you could have a talk to.
We were both at Conspiracy where he was climbing around the outside of the hotel, weren't we?
Yeah, we were. We'll get to that. So we went to so you've been in the UK, and then you left the UK after in Europe after a few months and headed to the US.
Where the Guff, Duff and Taff winners attended LA Con, whatever number it was, and first ever time that the three fan fund winners had been at the same venue.
Probably right.
During the same year. And Rob Hansen and Jack Herman and I, yes, we seem to leave an impression on the fans over there.
Yes, it's always good when you can get to the point where you're all there together and having a good time at those conventions. They make a lot of, you can make a lot of lifelong friendships there when you're in those conventions. So that was LA Con 1984.
Yeah.
And
also hit Icon in Iowa City. There was a small convention put on for Duff winner Jack Herman in Minneapolis. I went up to Ottawa for the World Fantasy Convention at the pushing of one of the local fans. He suggested I turn up and have an Australian angle on the program. So okay. Got to meet some of the interesting people up there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, again, if you put yourself out and decide that you're going to be helping out on the convention or sitting on the program, people are really happy to hear another voice, because a lot of those smaller conventions, they only hear the same ones all the time. And hearing somebody turn up from Australia, the accent is a bit different. So
yeah, I was from England, according to anyone who met me.
Really?
Because I'd had 4 months' influence of the British accent.
You didn't allow your accent to change, did you?
What accent?
Oh, okay. No, I don't think mine changed. Well, some people told me that when I lived there for 2.5 years, and somebody said that my accent changed a bit. I think it's bound to change a little bit. You don't have a choice. It just happens without you really knowing about it.
There are influences that you hear all the time, and it affects the way you speak. There's certain words which you hear repeated.
Well, also you get to the point where you say something, and people just don't understand you, so they say it again. And if you keep on saying it exactly the same way, they're still not going to understand you. So you end up changing the way you say it. They go, oh, that's what you mean. Yes, I just said that exactly the same way. At least you think you did, but you don't. But there we go. So, the US, good time, Had?
Good time, but I was growing a little bit of tired of travelling by this stage.
I would have thought so. 8 months is a heck of a long time to be
away. 8 months is a long time to be away, but I had a great time overall.
Okay.
Glad I did it. And, of course, my trip report doesn't exist.
So you came back to Australia?
At
the end of 84?
At the end, November 84, and I started work at Minotaur Books.
Okay.
With the plan of setting up their science fiction and fantasy section, which is what I did until 1988.
Okay.
And looked after that, and looked after a branch in Geelong very briefly before saying goodbye and setting up Slow Glass Books, which was the business I have run since then. I had a CBD shop in Melbourne from 1993, on the first floor, then 1996 for 6 years, and then the owner of the building died, and the new owners didn't want me in there, so I said goodbye, finished up back home, then an office in Northcote, and then back home again, and still doing a little bit, but yes, semi-retirement is a blessing.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
So you'd basically say that the bulk of your career has been associated with bookselling in one form or another.
In one form or another.
So how was that? How did you...
Oh, there were times when it was absolutely spectacular and a lot of fun. Unpacking those new books and saying, oh, yeah, one for me, oops. I don't describe myself as a collector. I describe myself as an obsessive-compulsive accumulator of printed matter.
Oh, okay. Yes, there's a lot of fans that are a bit like that end up getting to the point where half the time it's just a matter of owning the thing rather than reading it. But that's okay. That's right. There's nothing wrong with that. We've all got the situations where our bookshelves are far too full and have far too many books on them that we haven't read.
Another house that has books in every room because I'm trying to sort through it to work out what I want to get rid of, and I turn up there and I'm completely overwhelmed and nothing gets done.
That's a part of the problem as well. You have to start somewhere and just basically start on one bookshelf and just work your way through that and see what happens. But I'm going through the idea with my old paperbacks of reading the old ones, and when I've finished, getting rid of them. My view is that, if I want to read them again, I can always go and get them from the library or get them somehow. But I'm not going to go back to a lot of these things ever again.
Well,
just no time.
So many of my books were in storage, and I finished up buying a second copy because I wanted to read it, and I hadn't, because I had no idea which box that's...
Now, that is obsessive. When you get to the point where you can't find a book, so you buy a second copy, I have done that with a couple, I will admit. I think I've got 3 copies of The Daughter of Time, by Josephine Tay in the house. I've got at least three copies of each of the Earthsea books. I've got three copies of Dune, but Dune's a specific case because I had.
I've got at least two copies of Dune. I think Jenny's got one, so there's probably three copies of Dune. I've probably got about three or four copies of Stand on Zanzibar and The Sheep Look Up by John Brunner.
No, only one of those. I only got one of those. That's all right. I don't know. I'm pretty sure I know where those are. So how the bookselling trade? Did you you stayed in the science fiction field the whole time?
Specialised in science fiction, fantasy. I did a little bit of crime fiction for a few people, but that's because I've started reading crime fiction and really enjoying it.
There's a fair crossover between people that like science fiction and also those that like crime. It's not complete, but if you draw the Venn diagram, the intersection is really quite large. There's a lot of SF readers that also like reading crime fiction.
Yeah, well, I came across a publisher called Black Lizard, and that changed my reading matter.
Oh, yes.
Quite dramatically. It was Jim Thompson, David Goodis, Corner Woolrich. There was also too many Harry Whittington.
Yep.
And I just fell in love with crime fiction, not mystery fiction.
Right, okay. So you're almost a noirish end, isn't it? Sort of
not almost.
Completely and utterly.
Absolutely buried deep in the noir.
Oh, right. So it was the gritty stuff that you were looking for rather than none of the English cosy mysteries that a lot of people would like.
No, I've finished up now reading a lot of Scandinavian material, especially Icelandic, and a bit of Swedish, a bit of Norwegian, but the Icelandic stuff, oh, wow.
Yeah, reading the Icelandic stuff was one of the reasons that pushed me to wanting to go there, and I was very happy that I did, and you get a bit of an idea of what the place is like and what it would be like to live in. Not in the depths of winter, of course, because I didn't travel there in the depths of winter.
No, you were there in summer.
I was there in summer. It was so cold summer, and, you know, it's still bloody cold.
It didn't get very dark, did it?
No. It stayed fairly light for long periods of time.
Yep.
But it's a really excellent place to be. But getting back to the science fiction stuff, so who are the authors that, you mentioned some from early days. But yes. Later on, let's say when you got solidly into your bookselling period from the mid-70s onward, who were the people that you enjoyed reading?
The people I enjoyed reading, I enjoyed short fiction more than long fiction. So I was reading the short fiction of George Martin. I was reading James Tetrow Jr., Michael Bishop, and he's remained one of my favourites for many, many years. So I keep rereading his short fiction. I finally got into Le Guin at a later stage. I struggle with Le Guin.
Okay.
I've never read the Earthsea books.
I know,
shame on me. But it took me a long time to get round to reading Left Hand of Darkness. It took six tries for me to get into it.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And once I got into it, then on that final try, wow.
Well, I know of some people that have tried to read it and they say they just can't, it just doesn't work for them at all. And I loved that right from the beginning, but there we go.
I suspect my taste has changed. Nowadays I'm reading people like Claire North. Who is just
wonderful. Stunning. Yep, yep.
Her writing ability alone, let alone what she can produce with plots, there's so much variation in what she does.
Certainly an author that does not write the same book every time.
No.
Which is a good thing.
It's a very good thing.
Sometimes you actually want the same book because, you know, you like the last one so much. You'd really like something that's along the same lines, but she keeps on sort of doing away with those levels of expectation and sort of coming up with something new. So that's good. But who else
have I been liking? That's a good question. I try to think of everything I've enjoyed and it suddenly goes blank.
Yeah, that's why I like putting people on the spot, you see.
Thanks a lot. You've
got a whole pile of books here. Yeah,
there's a whole pile of books. That's for my sister. That's for two friends down in Geelong. That's for my brother. And then for Jenny to look through.
Oh, okay.
And then there's the
other pile over there.
The other pile of
from a lot of library ones, books,
including some one of Ian Mon's recommendations for this year.
Okay.
And I've got into Sarah Gailey lately. I've been quite impressed with her. I'm also a person who tends to read quite voraciously on the Arthur Clarke Awards.
Okay. Yep.
And this year I'm finally reading the first of the six. So no comment.
You're a little bit behind. I've at least read one of them.
Yeah, you've read the Mackay.
Yes, that's right. Which
you have commented on at an earlier time. I'm reading the Valdez Chilling Effect, and it, makes you wonder. Sometimes you wonder about that.
There are, in any awards shortlist, there's always going to be one or two where you're going to look at them and you're going to think, I have absolutely no idea how
There's awards which you look at and you go, how did that win?
Yeah, I know.
Michael Scott's Thraxus, which won a World Fantasy Award, and you think, why?
There's been those going all the way right back, right back in the Hugos as well. There's some of those.
They'd rather be right by Clifton and Riley.
Yes, we could go into that in really great detail, but let's not.
Because
David and I look after all that sort of stuff on other parts of the podcast. So. But
I've read all but one of the Clark winners, and there's been some absolutely stunning books amongst them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember you telling me that you always used to think that generally, if a Clark winner was good, it was one of the picks of the year, but they don't always necessarily have to be the best of that bunch. But
no, anyway. There have been occasions where I have done a little bit of questioning. The only winner I haven't read is the 1,000 pages of Neal Stephenson. I've got better things to do with my life.
Yeah, it's almost as if, if I'm going to read it before I die, do I have to make sure I've got 20 years left to be able to get to it? Some of these 1,000 pages is. That's daunting.
And it's close text.
Well, that's close to like four or five other books that you're not going to read.
I know.
If you read that. So that's too hard.
The longest horror I've read is probably one that you've read as well, and that's Under the Dome.
No, I actually haven't read that.
You have not read it?
I have not read
that. And
yet
you're obsessive about Stephen King.
Well, obsessive to a certain degree. Obsessive to the extent that I buy everything that he puts out. Not necessarily read it all. I'm a long way behind. I fell a long way behind. There was a couple of little things that I got involved in 99 and 2010, which had a tendency to use up a lot of my spare time. And based on that,
Because you've been a coach, a chair one and a half times is probably the best way to describe it.
That is about the best way to describe it. So that's things on the book side. What about film?
Film. I grew up watching Doctor Who
and
Star Trek.
Yep.
But the best was The Prisoner.
Oh, okay. Yep.
Patrick McGoohan.
Yep.
Yeah, that blew me away when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I enjoyed Blake 7 a little bit and other stuff that just turned up gradually. Alien.
There wasn't a lot.
In the
60s and 70s, there wasn't a lot. In fact, most of it was on, if you like to call it that, children's television.
6 o'clock on Sunday.
Yeah, it was the...
Doctor Who.
It was Doctor Who for half an hour or 25 minutes or whatever it was. And that was on the ABC, wasn't it? And then we had Ghost Ship? Do we have a music program on that time before Countdown came on to the ABC?
Oh, Countdown was way after.
Yeah, I know Countdown was way after, but anyway, doesn't matter. But Doctor Who was there. See, I never got to see the first seasons of Star Trek because I lived in the country at that stage when it was on, or yeah. I was living in a house that didn't ever turn the television over to commercial TV. It was only the ABC or nothing. And so I never got to see any of that.
There was a little bit of BBC material which came through. I think there was one called Doomwatch, which doesn't exist in any form. There was the...
Don't remember that one.
There's another one I'm trying to think of. Some of the stories still exist, but most of it got trashed.
Yeah. Yeah, it was mainly Doctor Who for me in terms of that was the major science fiction television that I was watching. And film, of course, was really difficult to get to. It was only... See, what would I think would be the first, other than watching something possibly on television, I would have thought that possibly 2001 might well have been the first film that I saw, science fiction film I saw in a cinema that you could call straight science fiction.
I saw that on late 60s in Geelong, and it absolutely blew me away in some ways, but there was also... Because I was so young, there were boring patches. I've gone back to it a number of times since. Every time it's been in the cinema on 70mm, whenever it's shown, I'll try and go and see it because it is one of the best movies.
Well, they had the 50th anniversary retrospective couple of years back, and I took the kids along and I forewarned them and I said, look, some of the parts of this are going to be really slow. And I didn't find any of it slow at all the second time around, or maybe eighth time around, whatever it was. But watching it this time again, I didn't find anything, any of it slow. I was fascinated by the whole thing.
Yeah, well, I took my daughter Lucy to see it at the Astor, and they've interviewed Dan Duryea and Lockwood on stage during that. And it, because she was heavily into media studies, it blew Lucy away quite thoroughly.
Yeah.
My wife, Jenny, never been really a fan of it. Okay. Wow.
Well, there's a lot of people that don't like it. But anyway, and then so what came after that?
Oh, probably Star Wars.
Yeah, but that was a number of years later, wasn't it?
That's a number of years later.
77, 78?
Yeah.
I can never remember exactly when it was, but it was somewhere
1977. The week I started the Space Age, basically.
Oh, right, okay. Yes, yeah. So you said. So, and then things started to kick off quite a lot. So did you've been getting along to the bulk of science fiction films that have turned up over the years? I mean, we are talking, that's 40-odd years ago, so there's been a fair number of them since.
There's been a fair number of science fiction, fantasy-related films, some of which have been marvelous, and some of which I think, why have they done these? Some of the Star Wars just drives me batty.
Yeah, they're
whoever came up with Jar Jar Binks should be removed from existence.
Well, basically, a lot of the science fiction stuff can be hit and miss. The Star Trek stuff seemed to be
uneven, to put it mildly.
Yeah, the was it the even number ones were the best, or the odd number ones? They seemed to have one good one and then one not so good one. And
it was the even numbers 2, 4, and 6. Because Search for Spock was the second one. Search for Spock, Wrath of Khan.
Oh, right. Okay, so the 2, 4, and 6 were good, but the 1, yeah. 3, 5...
Who wants to hear them singing Row, Row, Row Your Boat?
No, not me. That's for
not
sure.
Not me.
No.
There was Star Trek, there was Star Wars. I mean, in more recent times, there's been Christopher Nolan.
Yeah.
Inception, Interstellar.
He's up and down.
Tenet.
He's up and down. I didn't like Interstellar at all. I thought it left a... No.
Even though the film blacked out during one specific scene.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. We finished up with complimentary tickets for a later film, but it was still very frustrating having about 2 or 3 minutes of black screen. Got the dialogue.
Well, you and I would remember going to science fiction conventions in the 70s and 80s, and they would actually have a particular film program on, because sometimes that was the only chance you got to see some of those films.
That's right.
You know, like you get to see Forbidden Planet. I've seen that in black and white colour, and I've seen it in that red wash version, which was very, very weird. But those old conventions that we used to go to were pretty good in the sense that they were smallish, they weren't overly pretentious, they didn't try to do huge amount, but you got to know a lot of people from around Australia, and you know,
well,
I got to know you from science fiction conventions way back when in the late 70s.
Yes, we've known each other far too long. No, Unicon 2 was where I saw Night of the Living Dead.
Oh, okay, yeah.
There were other conventions. There was Wolf and various just little bits and pieces, but the piece de resistance for me was the Australian Media Science Fiction Convention, which was held in Adelaide one year, where Neil Gaiman turned up, and I found out that Doctor Who, Tomb of the Cybermen had been found. So I shut my dealer's table and I went and watched it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and it was absolutely awful and absolutely blissful at the same time.
Yes, well, that's the whole point about some of these guilty pleasures. You can look at them and you can think, aesthetically, this is pretty poor.
Yeah.
Critically, they're not very good. But geez, I'm enjoying having a good time.
Oh, good. It was so good just to see it again, because it was one of the early stories I saw when I was growing up.
Yep.
It was the second series of Patrick Troughton.
Oh, okay.
The Monster series.
Right.
And there's still so few of them, the stories around.
Well, I was lucky enough in that television came to the small country town where I grew up just about the time that the ABC was starting its run on Doctor Who. So I actually saw their first telecast of the first ever season series, the ones where the grandfather and the granddaughter, and she's working in a school, and the other teacher follows her back one day and goes back, and there's this funny-looking phone box.
And a junkyard. Yeah.
Very odd. Very odd.
I've seen some of them. Still enjoy dipping into the first two Doctors.
Oh, yeah. They're all good stuff. So what do you reckon have been your highlights over the time that you've been in science fiction? I would say the Guff trip was certainly
the
one
Guff
of those.
Trip was one
for
of them.
8 months, that's pretty damn good.
Just meeting the people over the years, professionals, fans, everything. Judging awards, even.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Aurealis Awards.
I haven't had the pleasure of that, and I think in some ways I'm really quite glad of that. Yes, okay. Yeah, the World Fantasy. We may have to talk about World Fantasy Awards at some stage and sort of go back and have a bit of a look at them. Or,
yeah, it was quite fascinating. One judge said, here are my recommendations for the awards, and it was one item in each of two categories. I'm off to be a guest at the convention, and the deadline was that weekend.
Fantastic.
Yeah, he'd read so much, and I gather he got stuck into me with other people because I steamrolled. Not my style.
Yeah, anyway.
The other four of us got on really well.
Okay. All right. Well, look, I think it will come to about an end for this particular little chat. Thank you, Justin. It's been good to sort of wander up and down along memory lane, so to speak.
Aimless fashion that I have.
Well, that's the whole point about some of these conversations. You just want to make them as an aimless fashion because that's what conversations are, and I think that's what works.
Yeah.
That's good. But anyway, thank you, Justin. Thank you for that.
Thank you, Perry.
Okay, thanks, Justin. That was a good interview, and we hope people found out a bit more about him that they didn't know. But that's about it for this week, I think. David, next episode? Not terribly sure what we're doing just as yet.
We're not sure what we're doing now, but it'll be in a fortnight from now.
Yeah, but that will be our last for the year. We're going to take a bit of a break then over the Christmas New Year period and come back in 2022 with our what is becoming now our standard first couple of episodes, namely Best Books of the Year. And that normally takes 1.5 episodes. Really,
well, it can run pretty long.
Yeah, we spread things out into lots of different categories and add them all, and then we'll probably talk about best TV and film. Mm. That'll probably be me more than
it will be you more than me. I watch almost
in
not.
Terms of the fact you don't watch quite a lot, but I seem to watch hardly heaps. But anyway, so that's where we'll be. But it also gives us a bit of time to read those books that we are going to get for Christmas and over the long, lazy days of summer, which is a good thing.
Okay.
All right, David, thank you very much.
No worries, and we'll see you in a fortnight's time.
See you then.
Okay, bye.